Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We have a fun show lined up. We're going to have some other people joining later on in the show. Right now, Brunel's here, Chris is here, and Aki's here. How are you three doing?
Yay.
Meh.
Eating Thai food, so I'm great.
So that's a meh, eh, mm.
Yeah, I said yay.
And a yay.
But also, I have a delivery, so I actually have to go for about 1 minute. It's because
you're going to be doing real soon too.
Well, I was going to say it's like 50% likely that the package was left at my neighbor's house, so I have to make sure I intercept it before it gets grabbed.
Oh, who's going to be rancid?
And it's not food; it's something else. But I'll be right back in 1 minute.
Well, in the meantime, we have a guest joining us this episode. From Critical Games all the way down in Australia, Josh Halloran is with us. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thank you. Tired as always, but feeling good.
It is especially tired for you because it is morning for you. Like, are you a morning person usually?
Not really, to be honest. Doing game development just kind of turned me into a night owl. But it's not too bad. It's 11 o'clock, so it's totally fine. Just a late night last night.
For the people who don't know who you are, tell us who you are, what you're here to chat about, what Critical Games is all about, the game that you are releasing very soon. Give us all the details. Who are you?
Sure. So basically, Critical Games is just the company name that I go under. I'm an indie developer from Australia. I've basically been making games since about 2011, mostly known for sort of creating Japanese-style RPGs on the PC, but I've also done work on mobile and things like that. My major series is the Ape Adventure series, the first game released back in 2015, and the second game just released last year and is finally coming to consoles on October 16th. So it's been a bit of a gap. But, finally made it through. And, basically it's a story-rich, turn-based Japanese-style RPG in the vein of classic Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest or Chrono Trigger, any of those sort of, classic RPGs. I tried to take elements from a lot of my favorites and really just craft a unique story around them that I hope players will really enjoy.
So what are some of your favorites? Let's start in the early days. What did you grow up playing? What did you enjoy?
So it was really sort of the PS1 where I fell in love with the genre, but I also played a lot of Super Nintendo RPGs. I was sort of in that era where it was all coexisting a bit. Like, it was just whatever you could get your hands on.
Yeah.
And I was sort of playing Chrono Trigger at the same time that I was playing Final Fantasy VII, and then a short time later, I was playing Final Fantasy X. Like, it was just kind of whatever was around and available at the time, or whatever my cousin had on hand, because he was really into JRPGs. Chrono Trigger is one of my absolute favorites, particularly just for its pacing and just really sharp design. I love Final Fantasy. Well, I pretty much love all the classic Final Fantasies, but I love Final Fantasy 9 and 10 in particular. And so this game really takes a lot of influence from Final Fantasy 10's battle system and Final Fantasy 9's sort of character work, I guess you'd say. I love the Mother series, the Earthbound series. So that's sort of why we took a little bit of influence from Mother 3 in the battle system UI and presentation. And just a lot of different things like that. I have played just about any JRPG you could imagine over the years, and have a lot of passion for most of them. So There's a little bit of everything, I would say. You know, there's a little bit of influence from Phantasy Star, there's a little bit of influence from Wild Arms, all over the place.
What are some obscure RPGs that you want to give a shout out to? Because a lot of people don't mention Wild Arms.
Yeah, I only found about Wild Arms properly quite late in the picture, like only, I want to say maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more. I remember like renting Wild Arms free once and it not quite clicking for me, but that was about my own experience with the series at the time. So, Wild Arms 1 in particular, I actually think is really good, and it goes under the radar just because it's, you know, really early 3D battle graphics. You have aged quite a bit.
It's the best one.
Everyone's very floppy. Sorry, Chris?
I was saying I agree with you. I was saying Wild Arms 1 is the best of the bunch, in my opinion, so.
I think they peaked there, and I don't think the other games are quite the same. It's always hard with like under the radar ones now, because I don't know what really is under the radar now. I mean, I really like Legend of Legaia as well, on PS1. I think that's a really good one,
yeah.
And I think no one really seems to bring that one up. I mean, you know, there's stuff like Terranigma, but I think that's become more widely known over the years, partly just because of its release history. It's hard to know like what the real unique ones are, but I mean, generally speaking, I think actually one I played not too long ago was Threads of Fate on PS1, and that is a real janky action RPG, but I love it regardless. I thought it was really charming.
Didn't that release with like two other RPGs? Square was doing Summer of Square. Remember getting some kind of like...
What was the game again?
Threads of Fate.
Oh yeah, that was the second game of the trio, and then the third was Chrono Cross, and the first was Legend of Mana.
Yeah, right.
I still have the little mini soundtracks that came with each one.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I mean, that's the amazing thing when you think about the 90s. It's like Square was just a machine for these games. Like, they were just releasing like great experimental stuff every year.
Yeah, what happened to them?
Money. They were like, we need Final Fantasy. We need that Final Fantasy money. What do we do to stand out?
I think the PS1 era Squaresoft was like peak Squaresoft.
It was.
Yeah.
It absolutely was. They were experimenting. We were getting the actual releases. It was just wonderful.
I would say put the caveat in that in the context of being an American gamer, yeah, because the late era SNES is super good and a really smooth transition from like your early Squaresoft to the like PlayStation era Squaresoft, you know, with stuff like Red Rhino Hio and Bahamut Lagoon, lots of others like that.
They haven't brought more of those America in recent years, with how legendary some of those titles have become, you know, translations. I'm amazed that Square hasn't been like, you know what? Yeah, let's make some money releasing.
We got Trials of Mana and Live Alive, so they're slowly picking it up. You know, from nothing for 20 years to like two within a couple of years.
I think it's because they're doing full remakes, right?
Yeah, Trials was both a port and a remake. They translated it and ported it over, and then of course remade it too. And I'm excited about that. I'm really hoping that they keep that going.
I want to try to recommend a obscure RPG unless you've already played, which in case that would be freaking awesome if you did. Have you ever played a game called Guardians Crusade back in the day?
I literally have it sitting on a shelf over there.
My man, see, I like you already. And just for full disclosure, even though we're reviewing the game on the show next week, I bought your game last year because I already felt confident in it being pretty freaking awesome. So,
thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, man. And again, you just mentioned you own Guardians Crusade, so my money went to the right man.
I need to get a copy of that. Yeah.
I just think it's a really unique one, right? Again, it just speaks to the experimental nature of the PS1 era. Like, even though it's not Square, it's just everyone was really trying to, you know, figure out a new approach to the genre at the time.
Mm-hmm. I Guardians Crusade is one of those games. There's a few games like this, but I wish that they would not had changed the title when moving it from Japan to the US. Night and Baby. It's an amazing.
We used to say it all the time. Like, I'm playing Night Baby.
It sounds like some kind of aphorism. Like, it's like Night and Baby.
It's such a great title.
And it's like, much more accurate to the game.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Like, I guess they were thinking no one's going to buy a game with the word baby in it.
Probably.
No, yeah. Kid Wiggum, they would still buy it.
Some obscure RPGs being mentioned in chat by, I'm going to butcher this name, and I am so sorry, Midare Mitsukane? I believe they're friends of yours, Josh, because they mentioned that one of your job duties in being a firefighter, but I nailed it. I don't believe you that I nailed it, but I'll take that anyway. Kudelka and Shadow Hearts.
Oh, yep.
Definitely.
I loved the original Shadow Hearts.
Me too.
The best part, still that freaking boat story. That voice was so bad. It's so bad. You know what I'm talking about? The old lady telling the horror story?
Yep. Yeah, I do.
It was so bad.
But like, it gives it a charm, right? Like, there's a charm to that era of like really bad, cheap voice acting.
Paying the janitor an extra $5 to stay a couple hours after.
You wonder sometimes.
I'm shocked that we're talking about PS1 era RPG. He hasn't said shit about Legend of Dragoon.
Yeah. I see the rose.
Okay, there we go. I was waiting for someone else to bring it up because I didn't want to harp on it for yet again another like 15 hours that I could easily talk about it.
It was the first RPG I ever finished. I absolutely love Dragoon.
Same here. It's my favorite one of all of them. I fucking love that game. To this day, it's in my top 10.
I'm still hoping for Sony to do something with it.
I think you'll appreciate this, both of you. Then, like, I did one of those random Twitter quizzes where someone goes, "What are your favorite RPGs in the PlayStation? Your top four that you'd keep, and the rest would get discarded." You know the deal. And I named like four games, like Breath of Fire 3 and like Persona 2. And like a friend of mine who I haven't talked to in a little bit just randomly chimes in and goes, "This is a good list, but I would totally swap Legend of Dragoon in for those." I'm like, what is with everybody in Legend of Dragoon that I'm not getting?
Because it's like, I need to go back and play it again.
I own a Rose action figure and I don't get it. I need to go back to it. The main thing I remember was being frustrated by the the high-end combos, when it's like, okay, what was the one guy, Lancert or Lucert? The guy had the green armor.
Lavitz.
Was like, Lavitz, yeah.
And his then last Albert, combo.
I guess he carried over the same combo, but the last combo I was dealing with for him before I stopped playing it can just go to hell. That thing was terrible.
I sat there and I mastered all of them just because I could. And I did it twice because I went through and I played through the game normally and maxed them all out near the end of the game. But there's actually a difference between Albert and Lavitz and how they do their additions. Some of them are faster for one and slower for the other. So I decided to start a whole new game and I mastered all of them for Lavitz before his character went the way of the dodo. So,
are you ever going to buy a PS5 so you could play it on?
Probably not. No.
No.
if they ever actually re-release the game to where I'm definitely not going to have to deal with any lag whatsoever, then maybe I'll buy whatever PlayStation that is.
What lag would there be in a PS1 game on an SD?
I don't know, but I don't trust it.
You should try playing Legend of Dragoon on a PAL system.
No, boy.
Now I want some details on that. Was it brutal?
It's not too bad on Legend of Dragoon. So, like, some games are more optimized than others. Like Final Fantasy VIII, I've always encountered a fair bit of lag, and like Wild Arms 1, all the music runs at about 0.75 speed. Which it still sounds really good. Like I that's kind of what I got used to. And then when I listen to the soundtrack on YouTube, it always sounds wrong.
I remember it having more of an R&B vibe. What's going on with this?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Dragoon just like it had a little more delay from what I recall compared to what I've seen of the NTSC version.
Mm. That would have made it so much harder to complete the faster paced ones. Jesus, no thank you.
Well, actually, I might have made it easier in some ways, to be honest. I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to do a direct comparison. I haven't looked into it too much for a while, but like there were lots of PAL PS1 games where it's like, you do the direct comparison, and this is just sluggish by comparison.
Oh, that's...
I would guess as long as the timing of the combo and the slowdown is matching up, it would still be good. It's if they out of sync is when it becomes a problem, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be out of sync, yeah. No, they've mastered that kind of thing. It's like, we didn't go back to the days of Sonic 1 on the Mega Drive, which was just, you know, the whole game ran at like half speed at best.
Oh, man. Have you ever tried Sonic the Hedgehog Genesis on the Game Boy Advance?
I've seen enough YouTube videos to know to stay away from that one.
Yeah.
I've heard that.
That one was pretty wild. It's a full price game, too.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, like in the early 2000s, Nintendo was selling like individual NES games for full price again as well. So,
oh yeah, but you could save them anywhere. The first time I beat Castlevania was on the NES Classic cart.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, saving helps a lot.
Yeah.
Bree's hanging out in chat saying that because she's there, she has to bring up Suikoden.
Oh, of course she does.
About that masterpiece.
Those games were good. I can't wait for the two pack coming out in what, March? Coming out? Get in one and two.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to restart my game of Suikoden 3 that I started in 2007. Maybe actually finish it this time.
Sergeant Duck.
I know, I love him. Sergeant Joe.
Oh, is it Joe? Okay.
His name is Sergeant Joe, but he is a duck.
Love that game.
That's not spoilers. You learn that in 5 minutes, within 5 minutes of the game starting. So
this duck has a title. I feel spoiled.
It's
not like on that game for some reason, and it turned out to be really good. Once you had to give it time to simmer, though. Admittedly,
you know what's funny about Suikoden 3 that I think was overlooked because it wasn't quite a thing back in 2002 or whenever it came out.
What?
Your Griffin friend, when you start the game as the one group with the kids and stuff from the village, the Griffin's name is Fubar. FUBAR.
Nice.
Yeah, I think they just did not either it wasn't a thing at that point, or they didn't realize it was a thing at that point, because why would you call unless you know.
Probably it was a thing at that point.
I mean, the duck's name was Joe.
Fubar was definitely a thing at that point, so I don't know what they.
Well, good thing they rejected the nominative determinism because the Griffin is actually functioning normally.
Those were big words. Anyway, we went on a hell of a tangent at the start of the show. 8-Bit Adventures 2 is hitting console next week. Tell us about this game. Give us the elevator pitch on what's going on in 8-Bit Adventures 2. Give us all the info.
I mean, should I basically just read the blurb?
Go for it.
So basically, the way I like to portray it is pilot your airship and explore a vast world map in 8-Bit Adventures 2, an exciting emotional tribute to the golden age of JRPGs. Strengthen your party's bonds with character-driven side quests and face off with challenging super bosses in dynamic turn-based battles. When a mistreated child with impossible powers threatens to reshape the world, a hero's disappearance kicks off a grand adventure and a battle for survival. It's a perfect entry point into the series for new and returning fans alike. So,
is there a big link between the first game and the second game, or is it really one of those situations where you could come into the second game not knowing anything about the?
So it's a direct sequel, like it does follow up, but you can also just absolutely come into it without any experience, and I very much designed it with that in mind, because I knew that a lot of people would be coming into the game without having played the first one, and that's proved especially true with the game coming to consoles as well. So, you know, the way I like to sort of describe it is, you know, like if you don't need to have played Ocarina of Time to get something out of Zelda Wind Waker, right? But at the same time, if you have played Ocarina of Time, it's like, hey, look, there's Ganondorf. Like, he's the same one. And, like, the backstory at the start is, like, talking about Ocarina of Time. You know, there's a link there that is addressed and explained, but it's
not... There is a link there.
Yeah, exactly. Or the other way I like to think of it is, sort of in Final Fantasy X, right? You know, Braska and Jekt and Auron have already gone on a pilgrimage, and you sort of... You know, the important parts of that journey are explained to you as you go through your new adventure. But it's like, you know, their journey serves as sort of the background for what your journey is in Final Fantasy X. So I want to ask two quick questions. Please,
and it relates to what you... Well, at least one of them relates to what you just said. Is that the reason why you can name who I'm assuming are characters from the first game, but the other characters have default names?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. The first game was, like, very traditional in the idea of, like, you name your whole party, but I started to realize how tricky that makes certain things as sort of, you know, the series goes on, so... And the other thing was that characters like Charlie, they appeared in 8-Bit Adventures 1, so they already had an established name. So I sort of tried to do this half-and-half approach.
That makes sense, then.
Yeah, full disclosure... I was going to say, full disclosure, after getting this game for review, I actually went back and bought the first game and started playing it.
Oh, wow, so, thank you.
Yeah, so...
It's a bit rough around the edges. I didn't quite have a budget at the time, but...
No, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine. But yeah, I did see, you know, when I named my characters and stuff and then started the second game and... So I like one thing I do appreciate is that you can rename your characters if you felt like you didn't do a good job the first time.
That was an update because I a few people were sort of like, look, I named this guy like really stupid. Can we change this? And then like basically they'd just send me their save file and I'd change it for them. But you know, after a couple of months, it was like, okay, I should really put in a renaming NPC.
I like the way it's framed too within the game, so that's pretty clever.
Okay, now
I was proud of that.
Because if I don't do it now, I'm going to go crazy tonight after the show is over.
Please go for it.
Dumb as this is going to sound, when you're in Driftwood for the first time, can you enter that second cave that's in the middle of the cave that you'd climb into on your first trip to town?
Mm-hmm.
You can.
Because
I'm trying to find my way in and I'm losing my freaking mind.
Just don't worry about it for now.
Okay. I was like, I gotta be able to get to this cave. It's right there.
You'll come back. You'll come back. It's okay. You'll come back in about like 15 hours and you'll be like, ah.
Oh, God. That's why I had to ask you because I would have never left. I was looking for walkthroughs, all kinds of stuff. Like, somebody's got gotten to that cave.
That's a little bit of a classic RPG thing of like, okay, look, just keep this in the back of your mind. You'll find a way in there later.
I'm glad you said that. Thank you for saving my sanity there.
No worries. Sorry for being the cause of you losing your sanity.
So I detected some like little hidden tributes to certain games, and I'm kind of curious to know if I'm right or if there are like other further games that inspired them. Okay, so and this includes the first game too. But, square doors you can enter, round doors you can enter, square doors you cannot. Is that directly from the first Mother game?
Spot on. Yep. I thought that was such a good idea. And I felt like no other game had ever done it. Like, not even the follow-up Earthbound games.
Yeah. So.
Wow. That really was the reference you caught. Ass freaking baller. I didn't even know that.
Immediately. Like, within I clocked it in a second. Huh?
All I saw was doors are closed and some doors are open. Didn't even get it.
Some doors are round or has a sign over them, and some doors are square. And you can't enter the square ones. You can enter the round ones.
That's really cool. Good catch.
The sound effect for screen transitions sounds like the original Final Fantasy. Is that on the mark?
So it's closest to Final Fantasy III. But, I mean, it could actually be the same sound effect now that I think about it. It's basically me fiddling with Family Tracker and trying to get sounds which like sound pretty close to that, but it was definitely the inspiration. Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of the cinematics too that I noticed in the second game really seem Mother 3 inspired. So you already kind of answered that one.
And Ninja Gaiden as well.
A lot of the shots were framed like Ninja Gaiden, I noticed, and I was like, nice. Which, by the way, speaking of obscure RPGs, Tecmo at the time made a Japan only RPG called Radia Senki that also had Ninja Gaiden style cutscenes.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Oh, well, check it out sometime. Radia Senki. Cool. It's been translated into English a couple of times now, so you can totally play it. It's an action RPG, but you know, it's got like levels and stuff, but you swing your sword in real time and everything. But yeah, it's a really interesting one, and it was made by a lot of the Ninja Gaiden people, so.
Wow.
The soundtrack
and. So it's ridiculously hard?
I haven't gotten to the point in the game where it would get ridiculously hard. I'm still kind of in the beginning, not beginning, but like the first quarter.
You probably get to the final boss, and if you lose to the final boss, you'll probably get sent like three quarters back into the game and have to do that over again.
Yeah, like, you know, they could do that. But I don't know. It's kind of traditional for RPGs that stayed in Japan to not be as hard as the ones that come over to the US. Because a lot of times they make them harder when they come over here.
Oh, that's right. There was an interview with the Ninja Gaiden team, wasn't there, where they talked about the fact that they thought, like, you know, Americans were getting games that were too easy, so they wanted to really challenge everyone. This is some quote like that I've read before.
Yeah, Ninja Gaiden 3 only has limited continues in the US. Japan, it's like the other two games in that it's free continues. So yeah, that's
ridiculous.
People have definitely put it out there that it was to that it was to thwart like renters, people who rent games.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know, sometimes the reasoning didn't line up, so I'm not sure I fully, like, buy into that for every game, but certainly some of them.
Well, that was Lion King, wasn't it? That was, like, the stated reason for Lion King's second level?
I think so, yeah, and that one was developed in the West, though, so, like, that makes a lot more sense there. But yeah, like, in Japan, you couldn't rent games, like, it was the law, you could not rent video games, so they didn't have that concern over there, so you know, it was often stuff that was added in translation, especially by working designs.
Yeah, that poor company, sometimes they hit the mark and sometimes they whiffed that frigger by a mile.
I feel like even at their best they kind of did a little of both.
Yeah, that's true. I stand by my biggest gripe with that company being their Silhouette Mirage port. They did a number on that game.
But between Purnell and I, we will reference every single RPG by the time this is over.
Yes.
I'm in the right place.
That's why I brought them to this interview. They handle everything for me. I just get to sit back and popcorn and enjoy the show.
Power popcorn. But like, if you were to name, like, I'm not going to say that. You mentioned PS1 was probably your most inspirational, like, your favorite era, but what was your favorite RPG on that system, like, flat out?
I mean, probably Final Fantasy IX. That one really connects with me.
I feel like it has to be.
That game has my favorite, too. By people.
Nice. Sorry, but
I guess the only one of them all that I repurchased and everything. It's good.
It's just like it's clearly like the culmination of like everything the series had done up to that point, right? Like it feels like that was like the, I don't know what you'd say, like the showcase of mastery.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was part of what they were going for, right? They were saying how, like, even though people liked 7 and 8, their idea is like, we want to go back to like the series roots. We want to bring back the crystals and the chocobos and the fantasy.
Fantasy.
And the crystal returns or the crystal comes back or something was the tagline, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although the way in which it does is a little bit burying the lead.
It's like briefly in the opening cutscene. Like a crystal? Or a splash? Just sport, isn't it?
We check the box, it counts.
Pretty much. You fight before fiends, you know.
You fight like, four fiends. They're a little. They're like, we have the four fiends at home.
I appreciate that. Trying to think here, because like I played, like I said, Chris has definitely played more of them than I have, especially because he's playing the first one too. Which, dang, God bless you on that. But I'm trying to think if you were to name the feature that you feel was the most important to bring to 8-Bit Adventures 2 from all of your experience playing these RPGs. Because I know you brought, because as Chris clearly pointed out to us, you put in a lot of different references and the such. But what would you say is probably the most important kind of feature or callback you wanted to include in this game to say, this is a game that I want people to play and experience this aspect of it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because, I mean, more than references, right, it's really just about the kind of taking all these different game mechanics that have been tried and tested in different ways and just trying to see, okay, like, how can we put a lot of this together into something that, you know, maybe has a few new elements and that sort of thing. And you know, really for me, I think the biggest thing in 8-Bit Adventures 2 was just kind of the Final Fantasy X battle system, like the conditional turn-based. Because I think that is such a great system. And, you know, a few other PS2 games of the era were definitely, like, using that really well, taking some pretty heavy inspiration from 10. But just in general, we don't have that many games that have really experimented with it. And so, you know, that's not only seeing the turn list on the side, but to me it's also things like being able to swap in characters without wasting a turn, right? So one of the things I'm really proud of in 8-Bit Adventures 2 is by the end, you know, you can essentially have strategies where you use the entire 7-character party in a single fight. And I think that feels really fun and dynamic, and that was something that I also would do in like some of the harder fights in Final Fantasy X. Because you can make use of everyone, it feels like everyone is participating, and you just have like, you know, it drastically increases the number of abilities and options that you have in the midst of battle. And then sort of the other thing I also did a play on was the augment system in the game is inspired by Final Fantasy IV DS, which had these augment mechanics. And basically they just like allow you to give characters, you know, unique special effects and bonuses and things like that. And if you're really clever, you can make some pretty amazing builds out of those. And if you combine that with party swapping and, you know, good use of the turn order and manipulating that turn order, I mean, you can absolutely dominate in battles if you really strategize effectively. So, I think so. Those are fantasy X mechanics.
And I look forward to experiencing that thing, because I've always said, as far as like, not even necessarily just Final Fantasy, but as far as turn-based RPGs go and real-time RPGs go, you know, like Final Fantasy like, gave the option of active mode and wait mode or whatever. I always felt that 10 was the best interpretation of what they could have for a wait mode, and that goes for pretty much most RPGs at this point. And Final Fantasy 12 being the best for active, if you were to play with the active vibe going on. But as much as I hear people always joke about Pan and but the laughing scene, like, no, that's the best part of it to me too. So I'm glad you said that.
I really think like there is something incredibly valuable there, and it's always like, I mean, I get it with 12 that they were trying to do something different, but it always baffles me that they never went back to the CTB and tried to like do a new version of that.
I think what it was is there was a period where all their market research was telling them that people didn't want the wait and see to keep going. They wanted action on the screen at all times. They were trying to implement that, and it just never quite got right. Like,
I wish you would go back to that too.
Do you know a game I feel like actually did like kind of elevate the spirit of that Final Fantasy X system with a, you know, more than the amount of people like that you have on screen at the same time kind of parties, like switching them out and like working them in that way? Huh?
Please, what is it?
Oh, Dragon Quest XI. I feel like that one kind of took a lot of what Final Fantasy X was bringing, and like, you know, really by the end of that game, like that's when you get to like the really hard stuff. Like that one ends up being like similarly, I think, really really cool on the strategy.
Another one to go revisit. Yes.
My one complaint I think with 11's battle system is that you don't see the turn order. And so
what, 11, like the online one, or are you talking about 12?
No, 12 is
the online one.
Yeah, we're talking about Dragon Quest 11, and Dragon 11's Quest the 11. Current one.
Yeah.
Thank heavens.
10 was the MMORPGA on that one. Yeah, I know it's weird because with Final Fantasy 11 was that, and 10 was, you know, yeah, it's blah.
They're so close to being in perfect alignment on the MMOs.
Ah, right.
it is a good system.
Yeah, and no, I understand about the turn order and stuff. That's always, I like that you brought turn order to an 8-bit RPG.
It's funny, it feels like really natural to be to have like that kind of system, because I mean,
and you know who's who's doing that like out there, the Kemco RPGs, like Xcreate and Hitpoint. On their you know, they come out with like an RPG every month for like, you know, the between $10 and $15, but like I played most of them. I have like 40 of them because of this show mostly.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of them will support like turn order and like, you know, and different like really cool like mechanics and stuff that like the major RPGs kind of ignore nowadays. So
that's really interesting. Okay. I knew that they like released a ton of them, but I've never actually played any of them. So that's really cool.
Well,
there's some gems in there. They release a lot of them, but there's some good ones in.
At some point when I get back into like actual writing, I want to use like my experience with all these games to like make a list and be like, here's where you can start with this. But list would have to change every single month.
they must have a lot of different teams working.
It's a bunch of different developers, yeah. And the developers I think have like, I mean, they're so similar aesthetically, and usually the systems are kind of like built upon whatever came out last, and they just like take the bits that work and usually leave behind the bits that don't, and then sometimes they just bring them back.
Ports of mobile games that have been out for quite a while.
Yeah, that's also true.
They have a backlog to go through.
I do think that probably actually is the way though to like make this kind of business sustainable, is like a lot of asset reuse and stuff like that nowadays.
With that company, absolutely, you're doing that.
Yeah. But I mean, like Trails has done that in the past, like to try and sort of make those games more, I guess, financially sustainable. And, you know, I think there probably is something to be said for that as like a sort of small scale business model in the games industry.
And, you know, what's interesting about that, too, is that the recent Final Fantasy Pixel remaster made all of the aesthetics uniform across the first six games instead of them being like kind of unique amongst themselves. And you would think that, like, you know, that kind of points to there being like a value to that, which, again, I'm going to point to Dragon Quest and say, hey, look what these guys have been doing since day one.
Yeah, I mean, 1-4 especially was. Very, very similar.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, we should probably bring it back to your game for a little bit more of our time together. We just got a sub. BX Latino Heat, thank you so much for your sub. Enjoy the emotes. Thank you for your support. Chatting with Josh Halloran of Critical Games, chatting about 8-Bit Adventures 2. How did the process go about bringing it to console? Because your previous games said we're on PC, some on mobile. How did you get this one on console?
So I found a company, Radalika Games, and basically just made a deal with them for porting. And because they basically developed a way to port RPG Maker games. Because 8-Bit Adventures 2 is a RPG Maker MV game. I always like to joke, it's literally about 135 plugins to try and expand what the base engine can do. But it's, you know, it's a really good foundation to like expedite the creation of like scenes and environments and battles for this kind of game. Rattalaika had a they were sort of developing technology to port RPG Maker games. So I got in touch with them, and we struck a deal, and it took longer than expected, but they were sort of developing that technology and working on getting the game up and running. And then sort of this year it's been a team effort of sort of me trying to address issues on the console versions and optimize the game in such a way that it can run properly on Switch and all that sort of thing. Because it's obviously very different than having a modern PC that can basically just handle any maybe less than optimized elements of the game. it's really just kind of been a back and forth of like them sending builds and me like identifying issues and we trying to fix things and me trying to optimize the game and all that sort of thing. And we just sort of in the last couple of months finally got to that point and passed certification. So it's been quite an intensive process, but I think the end result is quite good. So,
and we're a week away. How does it feel? Are you excited?
Excited and nervous. It's a funny thing of like, I know that most people really like the game and we've had a lot of positivity, but it's always sort of daunting taking it to a new audience and putting out something that you've put, for me, it's like 9 years of development on this. So sort of, it's always a little daunting when you put that out into the world again and, get sort of a new set of eyes on it. I'm excited as well. Yeah.
Well, it's
always
just
a mix when you're a developer.
Yeah, it's just about here. You said it's been a 9-year process. What was the hardest part of the development process in those 9 years? What was the toughest part of getting this game done?
It's a tough question to think back on because it is such a long period of time. But I think honestly, it is just the length of development. It's like trying not to get burned out and like just completely lose interest in what you're doing over that amount of time. I actually was fortunate in that I pretty much always stayed passionate about it, and I did feel like we were really like everything was coming together, and we were doing we're creating something that was going to work out and be a really good game. But there were definitely times, like particularly during the pandemic and all that, right? Like it just sort of felt very hard to motivate myself to keep sort of slogging away on it. And there were certainly times where it felt like it was just never going to be done. But the sort of the plan I'd made at the very start of development back in 2015 was, it didn't look too bad on paper. And based on the first game, I sort of thought it wasn't going to be more than 3 years. But It definitely was a lot more in practice, and particularly because I was trying to go for a higher level of sort of polish and presentation and all that sort of thing. It was a lot more involved than I realized. So it was quite a learning experience in that way as well.
And RPGs aren't the easiest games to develop either. We've had some friends on the show who've worked with their RPGs who've gone longer than you have. So
yeah, it's unfortunately it is a genre, because I know all sorts of people in this sort of indie RPG arena, and we all basically say the same things of like, yeah, RPGs are the just it's just one of those genres where there's just a ludicrous amount to you've got to make a lot of bespoke, like unique content, and there's just a lot of work that goes into the systems and just making sure things don't break. And of course they're very long form games, generally speaking. So
yeah,
there's a lot that goes into them, more than I ever realized.
A couple of exceptions. Do you know about oh no, go ahead, Pernell.
No, it's okay. I was going to say I think the one part of it is just, unlike a lot of genres, like even though every genre has its own trials and tribulations, I think RPGs are one of the few where you kind of have to get all of the parts right for the most part. Like,
yeah,
it's very rare where RPG is like a good battle system, but yeah, the narrative sucks. I still play through it. A lot of times people will go with the story, so I didn't play it. Or like, you got to get every bit right, and they all have their own challenges. So
I think that's my take on like why I give RPG developers a lot of kudos.
That's a great point, actually, because I mean, that's I've played plenty of action games with like, you know, really bad stories, right? Whereas I wouldn't do that for an RPG. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, since you don't know the Kemco games very well, so Kemco and Hit Point put out two on the Switch so far that I've played. They put out a couple of RPGs that are literally less than 2 hours long. Wow. They're fully JRPGs. You just have to play them and find out. But one of them is called Arch Lion Saga, and the other one is called Everdark Tower. And they're both meant to be quote-unquote lunch break RPGs.
I tell you what, as someone that's just made like a 30 to 40 hour RPG, that sounds like heaven.
Right? They're pretty good, too. I beat both of them. They're quite nice. Probably play them again at some point.
Cool. No, I think you're probably going to see some. Well, I don't know, because it's like this sort of standard of indie RPGs keeps going up. And so I think you'll probably have to see game length go down. Like there's a lot of really impressive indie RPGs that are sort of, you know, being made right now with like really high fidelity visuals. Games like My Familiar.
Yeah.
And so I think, it'll be interesting to see sort of, I think maybe game length will probably be a bit shorter, the more like unique assets that you need.
You know, it's kind of funny though. Like at least the last, like there's a couple of like really outstanding RPGs, action RPGs that I've played, and both of them were like, it's not that it's a trend, it's that people are just now finishing them. Because like, you know, Chained Echoes was a really good one, and that took 7 years to make. Ast Libra Revision was a really good one, and that took 15 years to make. So.
For some reason, everyone just like reached that point where it's like they were finally done.
Yeah, and now they're like
this pandemic time. Honestly, it's very possible. Maybe during the pandemic, probably like, this is my
heat. So there's a question: did you feel like your productivity got better or worse when things shut down?
Probably. I mean, it kind of up and down. Like it was probably better at first, and then like gradually degraded as the pandemic went on. Because we were like over here we were in lockdown for a while and you know that got a bit oppressive, I think it was probably a bit of a mix. Like there was definitely a groundswell at one point where it's like, okay, this is a great time just to get everything done, and then my game was also at Gamescom 2020 because that was online. And so that was a really big moment for me because IGN picked up my trailer and showed it on all their social media and all that sort of thing. So that was really energizing. But then I sort of think maybe it, like, you know, 6 months to a year after that was a bit of a harder go.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like we all kind of degraded a little bit after that. After that initial 2020
thing. Yeah.
Slowly crawling back up.
Yeah.
I am curious about one thing, though, now. I'm assuming that even though you're hard on development and the like, you haven't lost your passion for picking up and playing new games, too. Are there any RPGs, indie or otherwise, that you are either looking forward to or picked up on in the year 2024?
Yeah, okay. So in the year 2024... Now, this is the problem, right? I'm kind of behind on things, generally speaking. I did play Final Fantasy VII Rebirth this year, and I really loved that.
That's so good.
I think that is like the best battle system Square has made in a while. I think there's a lot of potential to sort of take that forward. But I really, really enjoyed that one. I mean, there's definitely plenty that I'm looking forward to. I mean, Metaphor looks amazing. Dragon Quest III HD, I'm really excited about.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, on the indie side of things, there's quite a few that I'm really excited about. Like, there's Quartet from Something Classic. I think I've played a bit of that, and I think that's going to be really good.
Yes, man.
There's a game that I've done a little bit of game design work on called Eternal Remnant, the first chapter. I think people are going to be very surprised by that one. I think that's got an excellent story. There's My Familia, which I've done a little bit of work on cutscenes on that game, but I think that's going to be really something special.
Okay,
I don't think
cutscenes
that anyone's actually seen, but at this stage. But I did some work on that earlier this year.
I played a little bit of that at MAGFest this year, so I was looking forward to that. Yes.
Yeah, that one's going to be great, I think.
I love the color pop too in that game.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, the real like purple. Aesthetic, but it really, really pops. There's some mm-hmm. amazing artistic talent on that game. I think it's a really good time for indie RPGs, and honestly, like AAA RPGs seem to have really picked up as well. So, theoretically, we'll have a Persona 6 in the not too distant future, and you know, who knows if that Final Fantasy 9 remake turn-based rumor is true, and all that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Getting that metaphor for me is like, I almost want that more than Persona 6. Like,
yeah, me too, honestly. Yeah.
I'm a lot more excited for metaphor than a new Persona. Like, I like the Persona games, but I like the fantasy elements of metaphor more than the current day Persona.
So metaphor the only thing I was going to say was that I came across something where I read that one of the developers of the game, they felt they really wanted to do metaphor because while they like a lot of the mechanics they started doing with the modern Persona games, they felt the whole high school bit was limiting what they could actually do with it.
Yeah.
Which was their motivation for stepping out of it and saying, let's make this metaphor thing.
Yeah, I'm liking, I played through the entire demo, the metaphor demo, and I like it a lot. I'm glad they seemingly got rid of the whole, let's, you know, convince all these monsters to join us so that we can sit there and level them up and then sacrifice them to each other to make other ones stronger and give them unique powers. So I didn't like any of that part of the Persona games, and they kind of ruined the game because those games were kind of focused on that. That's how you got really strong in those games. And I love that metaphor doesn't have that. I immediately, the moment that wasn't in there, I was like, oh, this is so much better.
It's like, I'm sold.
Yeah. I'm actually excited for once. I've never liked any of the Persona games. I loved my time with Metaphor.
And I think that's probably what Metaphor is going to end up being. Is it's going to be like the Atlas RPG for like more traditional JRPG fans.
Yeah,
and I am so for that.
Mm.
Yeah, I can't wait for that thing. Like, because for me, even like I personally like the modern over fantasy. The problem was when they started focusing heavily on, again, just the school concept. You're always a high schooler. You're already stuck to a school schedule. Oh, this junk. It felt so limiting. Like, Persona 2,
the second one. We have a Big Adam joining us. Hold on a sec. We got Big Adam joining. Mr. Big Adam, how are you doing today, sir?
Oh, you know, I'm doing well. Doing about as well as I can for a Monday night. You know what I mean? Having worked all day, just like most.
Yeah. We're chatting with Josh Halloran of Critical Games about 8-Bit Adventures 2. Have you heard of the game, Adam?
Honestly, I have not.
Would you like to know more about it?
Would you like to know more? Is this a Demolition Man moment? What's happening?
It is.
Sure.
Josh, sell Adam on the game. Tell him about the game.
So basically, it's a story-rich, turn-based, Japanese-style RPG in the vein of classic Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest and Chrono Trigger and all that sort of jazz. It's a retro throwback JRPG, but with, I think a pretty unique story and a fun new take on the Final Fantasy X battle system.
Okay. See, I'm kind of a weird gamer. I can only really handle one JRPG a year because turn-based combat, in my opinion, is a little on the boring side. I'm way in the minority on that, so, you know, I'm the weirdo, I know that.
This might not be the game for you, then.
I'm currently playing Octopath Traveler for the first time, and that's scratching several of the right edges.
Nice.
I totally understand where you're coming from with the not liking the turn-based. There are times I like turn-based, but only on occasion. I much prefer full action, so I totally understand you.
Yeah, action RPGs tend to be kind of my niche, just because I feel like I'm actually doing stuff more frequently. And I know that's just a mental blocker. I know that's just a mental thing, but that's how my brain works, so.
That's fair.
And that's why I like Final Fantasy XII so much.
Nah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like...
Yeah.
See, it's, I feel like I'm doing less in Final Fantasy XII than I do in any other Final Fantasy.
As for me, I am a...
As for you?
Go ahead, Chris. Chris?
Oh, internet yeah, I was just going to say, as for me, I'm like a patron at the... hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Damn it.
That went remarkably well.
Things are going great tonight.
Maybe a bit of lag.
Now we're getting the lag. Now we're running. Oh, man. Josh, I know we've been chatting for a while. Is there anything you wanted to chat about that we didn't bring up?
That's a good question, actually. I guess the main thing really is just that the game comes out on October 16th. So it's like, if you like any of the sort of games we've discussed, I hope, maybe people will check it out. There's a demo that's coming to Switch and Xbox. I'm trying to think of what exactly the time zone would be, but it's like on the 9th, whatever the 9th is in your respective time zone. The demo will be coming to PlayStation as well. It's just held up a bit by certification at the moment. So if you're interested in sort of, that style of game, I highly recommend you just download the demo and give it a try and see if it's going to be your kind of thing.
Is it a self-contained demo, or is it one of those demos that carries over to...
It is just a self-contained demo. It basically contains like a level select, so you can either do just the opening little prologue of the game, which is about sort of 5 to 10 minutes. You can do a dungeon from sort of about 5 hours in, or you can do a little town sequence, which has a optional boss fight and sort of gives you a preview of a world map and that sort of thing. It's sort of made to be, because RPGs are like a hard thing to demo, and they tend not to necessarily, leap out of the gate in terms of speed and action. Yeah. I thought it was a good idea to sort of offer a little, tasting of different aspects of the game.
It's like a video game flight. I appreciate that.
Exactly.
It's also funny. I haven't worked in games in 13, 14 years now. And it's funny to me to hear that Sony is still the odd ducks when it comes to certing. Because that, when the game that I worked on, that was definitely a thing.
The others are a little quicker.
Yeah, they certainly are, and they always have been.
That's interesting to hear. I've heard similar things, but I'm never sure how much to actually say on those kind of topics with, NDAs and all that type of thing.
Oh, don't worry. No one listens to this show. Sure. You're fine.
You're under contract. I sure as hell ain't. I can say whatever I want. Don't stop. I know.
Adam's here, gonna get here. Everyone in trouble.
Yeah, good.
I mean, Aki's if he was
immediately on the hate train.
Yes, I am. Maybe if they did something with the Legend of Dragoon IP, maybe I wouldn't. Maybe. But until they do, then go fuck themselves. Yeah.
Oh man, Andy Sperry joined us. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Good to see you guys. How's everybody doing?
We're doing pretty good. We are chatting with Josh Halloran of Critical Games, chatting about 8-Bit Adventures 2. I think we are nearing the tail end of the discussion. Not sure if anyone else had any more questions before we wrap that up or not. Been over an hour now. Been a good chat. I'm having fun with this one. I don't know how much we actually talked about the game, because we talked about literally everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what 90% of our conversation was.
Well, it went on my Switch wish list.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, that is the other thing, right? Is like that does help us out. So if you want to just like keep track of the game and, you know, make sure that you receive the news when it actually comes out, then please give us a wish list on whatever platform of choice. Because yeah, we're going to come out on Nintendo Switch, Xbox One, Xbox Series X and S, PlayStation 4, and PlayStation 5.
So hitting everything.
Which yeah, in some ways is a good idea, and in other ways is a very bad idea, but I think we've got a handle on it now.
I know Rattle Lake is pretty good about getting their games on everything.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that is really their goal, is always to get the game on everything.
We are fans of Rattle Lake. They put out a lot of good
stuff. Yeah, they're great.
But yeah, did anyone else have any questions? I will take... Everyone's resounding silence is a no. Josh, it has been a pleasure having you on the show chatting with us. One more time, how can people keep up to date with you, what you're doing, game, all of that in?
So you can follow me at Critical Games AU on Twitter/X. You can check out the 8-Bit Adventures 2 Steam page because I post updates there. There's now on PlayStation there's a blog, so I'll be keeping that updated, and there's a news channel on Nintendo Switch, so I'll be using that too. But generally speaking, if you type in 8-Bit Adventures 2, you'll find me and whatever's going on with the game. We've got some free DLC coming early next year.
Ooh.
So I hope people will really enjoy that. It's basically going to be some like post-game challenges with some new story and a new 50 sort of 50 area dungeon. Wow. So it should be a fun one. Basically, you're hunting down like these really really tough bosses to try and open up the path to something story important. So yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Very cool. It's not often that indie RPGs get DLC, so that's cool to hear.
Yeah, and yeah, completely free. So just it'll just come as an update for everyone that owns the game. So
very awesome.
Okay, cool.
All right, well, but, Josh,
thank you so much for having me on and for the opportunity to talk about the game and just talk about sort of RPGs in general.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. You'll have to come back on again sometime, preferably before 9 years when your next game is ready. But we'll see how things go.
I've got a couple of projects in the works at the moment, so it'll definitely be before 9 years.
Well, keep us posted, and we would love to have you back on again sometime.
Please, yeah. No, I mean, if all goes to plan, hopefully maybe next year.
Sounds good. Well, we will let you get going. Have yourself a wonderful day over there, because it's Australia, and it's just about, what, noon there now?
Yeah, it's about 10 past 12.
You have yourself a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, everyone.
You have any final words?
Please support indie RPGs.
Hooray.
And yeah, 8-Bit Adventures 2 out on October 16th.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Night.
All right. That was fun. That was a good chat. Adam and Andy, how are you two doing?
Good.
Doing pretty good.
I'm just tired.
That's it. Everyone just tired tonight.
Yeah,
I know I am. Mondays are rough, dude.
I'm exhausted. It's like 9 o'clock, and I'm ready to.
I am too. Real talk.
Yeah. Monday's kind of a real gunpla.
So I'm feeling.
My brother-in-law is going to trick me into playing Deadlock when I'm done here, but I'm going to go to bed soon after that.
Well, we won't hold you up much longer. We'll let you get to your Deadlock. Should we dive into reviews? We only got a handful to talk about tonight.
Sure.
All right, let's kick things off with hashtag Drive Rally, developed and published by Pixel Perfect Dude, released September 25th on Steam Early Access for $19.99. Drive Rally is an arcade-inspired rally driving experience set in the golden racing era of the 90s. Grab your co-driver and burn some rubber on iconic race-winning cars across a variety of terrains and some of the most iconic rallying locations in the world. Adam, tell us about your time with Drive Rally.
Drive Rally. So, imagine that it's 1992, okay? Imagine that you are in 1992. You have your 16-bit era console of choice. It's sitting there. It's all ready to play. It's plugged into the TV. Your parents got it on channel 3 for you. You're ready to fly, okay? You go to the game rental store. You pick up a copy of the newest rally racing game. That is what this game would be had this game been released then. And what I mean by that is it very much feels like a 16-bit era arcade style racing game where you're just progressing through a very linear story with specific cars on specific tracks. And, you know, how fast you complete that in comparison to other people, typical rally scoring stuff, is, you know, how you progress. And it keeps track of everything through, like, a racing, like, logbook almost, which is pretty cool. The thing that sets this apart from those games is literally nothing but the graphics.
Okay.
The graphics right are from current day. They're very cool and slick, in my opinion. They're kind of cartoony, a little on the cel-shaded side. It's a lot of fun and very goofy in appearance, which is what an arcade game like that kind of needs or kind of wants to be. Because anymore, there are so many games that are trying to be very serious and very like simulator-esque. It's cool to have something that's a little extra on the arcadey side while not going straight up, you know, cartoon a la Mario Kart kind of thing. It's still paying respect to like real cars and real tracks and real countries and real places, but it's using a cartoon style to do so. I thought that was a really cool line down the middle. I was a little bummed out that the game is as on rails as it is. Like I said, it's very akin to a 16-bit era racing game. It's there is a car, and you race on the track when it is that page of the book to do so. All that being said, the game plays really well. It's a really fun little arcade racer. It's not super difficult at all. There's no like damage or, you know, damage like penalization through car performance or anything like that. It's just you kind of bump off the side and keep on trucking. Like, I mean, that's really all it kind of boils down to. Really anybody could pick this game up and play it if they were any kind of racing game enthusiast. It does not require a large amount of skill set to play whatsoever. It definitely leans a lot more on the fun side. Now, one thing I will say that was a little bit disappointing going into it was in seeing a lot of the lead-up advertising for the game, they had a lot of scenes with the characters like doing kind of like cartoony things before like races or like in between the racing shots of the thing. And a lot of those animations, they're very, very few and far between. Very, very few and far between. It really, really, really just goes from the, like, I think there's four different classes that you can race in, and they all go through different stages. And, I mean, each one of the class has, I think it's like 20 or 25 races, something like that. And they're all in order. You get the car that is set up for that race. And when that is done, you go on to the next one. That is that, and that's it. There's no real car selection. You can upgrade features of the car that you're using, but honestly, I never really found a reason to do so. Other than being like more cosmetic, because every race has a new car, and I never tend to do really poorly with any of the just given cars. So like a lot of that was kind of it seemed like to be more for the funsies of it as opposed to it being a general or genuine effect on the game. That was a little disappointing, but that's only because of common expectation with current gen racing games. There's a lot of customizability, I should say. And there's a lot of performance increases that do very much increase, you know, X, Y, or Z performance of said vehicle. I just didn't feel like the upgrade system in this game really held all that much weight. I felt like if you wanted to ignore that, you kind of could.
Yeah.
But all that to say, like I said, the game, it is a fun game. It is a fun little arcade racing game that's got cute graphics and does pay good homage to that generation of both rally cars and several different classes therein, and the places and, you know, situations that they raced in. It's a fun game, in my opinion. It's definitely lacking on the content one would expect from a current generation as far as depth is concerned. But past that, it does exactly, I think, what it set out to do, which was be a fun little drift arcade game.
Sometimes that's all you need, just a fun little diversion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And not everything needs to be, you know, a crazy 75-hour deep experience. Yeah. Sometimes games can just be games, you know?
Yeah. Well, this one is in early access right now. The website doesn't really expand too much about what they plan to do in early access. They just say things like various additional elements focusing on adding new content and balance adjustment based on community feedback. Like, they don't have any specifics that they want to do.
They don't have a roadmap set up. Yeah.
Yeah. So they mentioned new co-pilots. I don't know if the co-pilots were anything memorable.
So they were, I mean, they were fun and very kind of cartoony. Like the one series is like a German mountain guy, and he's kind of aggressive. And when you like bump into a wall, he's like, "Ah, we had harder crashes than that." And, you know, insert some German town here. He's like, "Keep going." Like, it's goofy, punny stuff like that. But again, even that, it's not terribly deep in content, but it is there and it is fun.
Yeah. Well, it's $20. Is this something that people should jump in on now? Should they wish list it? Keep their eye on it? What do you think about Drive Rally? What,
for $20, I say go for it. If you're in the market for just a fun, kind of easy to jump into, easy to pick up where you left off, play here and there for a little while, kind of arcade racing game, that's not going to require you to buy a sim wheel and, you know, all this other stuff, or be prepared to get absolutely spanked by the computers because it's not going to happen. I definitely say go for it, especially for $20. They've been adding a lot of content. They've been adding new tracks and new events and stuff like that piece by piece. So the developer is definitely hard at work on the game, and it shows. If you look at their Steam page and the store page, there's updates, I think it's every couple of weeks at this point, where they're just putting new content into the game. So I think for $20, like I said, if you're in the market for an arcade racer, definitely. It's going to get supported by the developer. The game definitely has somewhat of a future. And I mean, for $20 in today's economy, you can't beat that.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. Adam, that's it for you. We'll let you get going to your Deadlock game. This is a quick in and out for you.
Quick in and out. I appreciate y'all for having me again and just being kind of a dine and dash kind of guy. But
we love having you on, and our night for rap.
Yes, indeed you will. 9 p.m., good sir.
Idle Tuesday. Woo!
Idle Tuesday. My name's Tony Khan, and I definitely didn't do cocaine before we started this episode. Let's fucking go.
Oh, wait. I totally forgot your intro. Big Adam's here.
You little hillbilly bitch.
See, now I feel more at home.
Yeah.
That's the good stuff.
What do we have to do? You know, we have like so many sounds.
Just too many. 48.
Yeah. Right.
My
right
soundboard
for fucking the rest of the channel.
Yeah. My soundboard for the rest of the channel is entirely full. And every time Joe or myself come up with a new clip that's funny to be added to our soundboard, it's actually come down to we need to take a vote between the people that watch wrestling together. Because the soundboard is not only full, but it's also quality.
It's really, it's disgustingly good. How much fun stuff we have.
And to be fair, it's like 4 years of constant, just nonsensical grooming. So
if I may say so myself, it is
fantastic.
Fantastic.
That's a true story. It's a true story.
All right, Adam, any final words before we let you go?
If you live anywhere close to Florida, GTFO, for real. Yeah. That looks super fucked and dangerous. And don't risk it. It ain't worth it. You can get a new house. Can't get a new you.
Sound advice.
Yeah. Be safe. Be cool to everybody. Don't be dicks.
All right, Adam, have a good one.
You as well. Take care, y'all.
Peace. Next game to talk about is called Kvark, developed by Latest Past and Pre-Run Creative, or P-Run Creative, Parun Creative, I don't know. Published by Parun Creative, released out of Steam Early Access October 3rd for $19.99. Kvark is an FPS game set in a fictional version of the 80s Czech Republic. The player finds themselves in an underground facility that is falling apart as they travel through it. They'll have to navigate dark tunnels, encounter many obstacles and enemies that will test their skills. Andy, tell us about your time with Kvark.
So, in Kvark, as you mentioned, you play as a valued employee of an underground mining and research facility where workplace hazards and near-fatal accidents are just part of the job. You're not getting paid, but instead walk away with a sense of pride and accomplishment in helping to advance the human race. Yay!
Yay!
Kvark is, in simple terms, playing off the classic feel of an 80s boomer shooter. Some might compare it to the legendary Half-Life with a little mix of Stalker, as it takes place in a fictional version of the 80s Czech Republic. And by the way, I believe at this point, it's very, very cool. Yeah, at this point, I believe I've become the new boomer shooter reviewer of the SML podcast. So my professional opinion definitely matters in this. Aside from the initial intro that features an employee training video, very well done, and the occasional poster hung up through the mini dorm or office type spaces within the facility, there is really not much tie back to the setting and overall not much story depth, in my opinion. Sure, there's a few like little messages lying about too with a little like Soviet humor, but nothing that drew me in for more as far as the story goes, but that's totally fine. That's I feel like stories in boomer shooters are pretty few and far in between. There is something that's happening in the facility that is turning the workers into humanoid monsters. Radiation is seeping through, and any quote-unquote monsters are just hallucinations according to the facility leaders. That is, until they get attacked by one. The gameplay itself is comprised of underground exploration through a terror-filled underground facility, and follows what you would normally encounter in a boomer shooter title. If it moves, you should probably shoot it. A mostly linear pathway leads the player to the next encounter of enemies, encountering locked doors, switch puzzles, and a few secret paths along the way. John Carpenter or 80s dark synth soundtrack, as I like to say, sets a eerie tone as you traverse the once busy halls of the facility, which, depending on the level, can get a little repetitive, but honestly, it really locks you in. I myself had a few jump scares from enemies and maybe one or two from a neighbor hitting the garage with a basketball recently. So between the soundtrack and things going on in the game itself, you're locked. A heavy arsenal of shotguns, pistols, ARs, and a wrench to bash enemies are all at your disposal to keep track of those who have turned. Keep back those who have turned. Each packing a nice feel and a heavy hit. The enemy decapitations really sold the satisfaction factor for me in this one, especially since enemies are aggravatingly accurate with shots and do a load of damage. You've got multiple enemies that zero in on your location, sometimes even through walls, which was a little rough and frustrating. But you know, the game has a few balancing issues. They need a little bit of work, but there are difficulty settings available for the not so good at boomer shooter players like myself, even though I am an expert. A simple perk system is available towards the end of the first chapter, there being three chapters total right now. Improving skills by means of a chemical found throughout the facility called Anethium. This improves melee damage, health, resistance, max shield, rate of fire, those kind of things. Save points mark specific points in the level and are usually found right before a fight with a large group of enemies. Ammo, health, and armor are also available to give the player a little extra edge before getting demolished. Those are also found just throughout the section of the chapters as well, too. Enemy types seem a little thin, with you fighting kind of the same hazmat suit humanoid charging after you from a hallway, or rats, or mounted or flying turrets, the flying turrets being the bane of my existence. But with the addition of Chapter 2, and now that the game is officially released 1.0 out of Early Access, Chapter 3, woo! It adds some new content with more interactable items, weapons, and enemies, and also some new perks to the game as well. So the game is officially out of Early Access as of October 3rd, and I would say is a fun boomer shooter type, you know, filled with lots of blood and chaos, you know, cool enemies.
Oh, some fun insanity.
Some very fun insanity. Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, it is a $20 game. What are your thoughts?
I'd say go ahead and pick it up, you know, or try it out, you know, if you feel the need to. I was never like raised on boomer shooters, you know. I feel like they kind of have a similar feel now that I've played so many. But yeah, I mean this one doesn't really do anything different, but it was still enjoyable. Between the soundtrack and the levels, I had a good time with it.
Cool. All right. Well, Andy, that's it for you. We'll let you get going. Another in and out for you. You and
you know, actually tonight I can stick around. It's Monday night. I got no kids, so
fuck yeah, man. I'll stick around. All right.
Hell yeah.
Cool. Next game, Bloomtown, A Different Story, developed by Different Sense Games and Lazy Bear Games, published by Twin Sails Interactive. Released September 24th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $24.99. Bloomtown, A Different Story is a narrative JRPG mixing turn-based combat, monster taming, and social RPG set in a seemingly pleasant 1960s Americana world. Join Emily and her group of friends to save their cozy town from the demonic creatures that live in the hearts of its residents. For now, what is going on in Bloomtown, A Different Story?
So in Bloomtown, you primarily take control of a little girl named Emily, who is sent to live in the town of Bloomtown for the summer with their grandfather, Emily's, and her brother, Chester. So their time is meant to be for the summer, which is the time frame that encapsulates your adventure. And very quickly after you get there, you realize things aren't quite right in this town. Children are disappearing. No one seems to be picking up on it, and through sheer coincidence and luck, well, maybe not so much of a coincidence, actually, you kind of stumble into the midst of all of it, and you find yourself in a need to resolve this mystery before the end of your summer vacation, though primarily it's because you sign a contract with a being named Lucifer, who pretty much requires that you do so, or else you forfeit your soul to him at the end of your summer vacation. So... Mm. This ends up embracing a bit of exploration and time management where you spend your day exploring the quaint town of Bloomtown and its many districts, talking to residents, getting a part-time job to earn some money, doing various social interactions with your party members to gain typical, I don't want to say it's a social link, but basically establish social link benefits with them and just kind of get a better feel for the town itself, because that's a large part of what makes the game special is exploring the town and becoming acquainted with its residents. However, at night, or whenever you want, honestly, but you'd be a fool to do it anytime but at night. You'd be wasting valuable time. You are able to call your friends on the telephone and adventure into the underside, which is essentially the corrupted version of the world of the town of Bloomtown. And while you're in the underside, there will be creatures wandering around, pretty much shadowy human-shaped beings, and when you engage them in combat, you fight pretty cool, honestly pretty cool looking monsters. Combat is a traditional turn-based structure. All four of your party members, you pretty much almost always fight with them. There's a few times where they kind of break off or separate, but you generally end up with a party of four, you and your three friends, or rather you, your friend, two friends, and your brother. And in turn-based order, you get choices between a basic melee attack, a ranged firearm attack, or using a spell through your summoned familiar. Sound familiar? Well, it should, because a lot of this is kind of like emulating the Persona vibe, which, quite frankly, I'm not going to complain about, because if you were listening to the interview earlier in the episode, you probably heard comments about it's nice to see other companies try to take their own spin on this thing. And I like what they did here. In fact, one of the more interesting parts about what they changed here compared to that style of game is how you actually acquire new familiars. And Persona-esque games and Shin Megami Tensei games, rather, you generally do this by way of having conversations with monsters. And through a series of fairly trial-and-error choices, you may or may not get the monster. And this game is done by what's essentially rolling two D6s. And depending on what number you roll, that determines whether or not you get the monster or not. The roll itself is influenced, or rather boosted, by your social stats, though. And different monsters lean on different social stats. So you might be fighting a fishbowl monster, and to tame him, you have to roll the dice, but it's primarily boosted by guts. So if you have a high gut stat, it's more likely you're going to succeed on your encounter roll to get the monster in your party. Another times, if you're really doing poorly in proficiency and the monster requires proficiency, well, you're going to have a hard time getting that monster into your squadron. However, if you decide you do not want to try to tame a monster, and again, just like in Shin Megami Tensei, or rather the later Persona games in this case, you can't attempt to converse with these monsters, attempt to come get them into your party, unless you knock them all out by targeting their weaknesses. And at that point, if you decide you don't want to try to tame a monster, you can just do an all-out attack and just do major damage to the entire enemy party. But more often than not, if you're doing this, you're trying to get some monsters. In addition, monsters, or rather the tamed familiars slash monsters, do not level up. Instead, you have to fuse multiples of monsters into one to give them the experience points from the monsters just to get them boots. So again, generally, you're going to be trying to tame as many monsters as you can, because there will be some monsters that you want to actually use in your party as new magic casters, because again, by getting new monsters, you get stat boosts and you also get elemental affinities. But you'll need to take dud monsters, or rather fodder monsters, and fuse them into the ones you actually care about in order to make them stronger and potentially learn new spells. Each scenario in this game takes place over a series of days. There's no actual calendar, mind you, but there are just like, you know, the Sunday through Saturday time structure. And if you take too long, there may be a game over. What is that game over? I couldn't tell you, because I don't wait too freaking long to get missions accomplished. I get things done. But I would like to believe that if you fail, you're in trouble. So don't let that happen. The game does a lot that I like. It may be a little bit of stumping for the game, because I've been gassed for it since that first trailer came out, because the music in that trailer was really good. But that musical approach definitely carried over to the main game as well. Music in this game is really good. Graphically, I think it does a good job of standing out. I do find myself wishing that the characters had to lean a little bit more into the taking into believing that there's another side to their world and there's monsters inhabiting it and they have magic summoning beings, blah, 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 blah. But sometimes I have to tell myself to just accept that not every game is going to go through the dynamic of trying to lay out the shock and awe that comes from learning there's a weird world to your normal existence. And also, it's summer vacation. They're kids. If anything, maybe they're waiting their whole lives for something like this to happen. So I was like, yes, I'm not going to question. I'm going to do it. But nonetheless, being an old fart, I always found myself going, why are these kids so just accepting of everything and not concerned? Whatever, let's have fun. And frankly, the game does what I want it to do. I've had a great time with it. And I like the fact also that you can listen to all the music in like your bedroom, and you can find records hidden throughout the town that will allow you to select the music and listen to whenever you want. I think that's a particularly cool feature, and I feel like more games should do things like that. Even if they can't do it thematically, like finding records for your 1960s record player, because this game takes place in like the 60s or 70s, by the way. But I just like the fact that it exists in this game, and I wish more games found a way to incorporate their music by way of choice into your experience. I'm not going to ramble much more about this game, because I feel like I've pretty much said everything needs to be really said about it. Also, I didn't really experience any glitches or anything like that. If there are glitches out there, I'm sorry. I didn't experience them. Wait, no, I'm not. I'm glad I didn't experience them. Hope you don't. But yeah, I didn't have any issues like that. So at the end of the day, I think Bloomtown delivered what it set out to do. I feel as though, well, I'll say the rest after you do that thing you do.
Well, it is a $24.99 game. What are your thoughts on that?
I feel as though if you're the type of person that likes, you know, the later Persona vibe and how that time management bit in monster battling and Underside, Darkside, Dark Hour, any whatever. If you like that concept, but you would like to give it a try by an indie developer outside of the Persona spectrum and see how they do with it, I don't think you'll be disappointed in Bloomtown. It's a nice indie version of that, and it does a lot of things right in some ways that Persona doesn't even. So I think this is a solid buy and worth your time and money.
All right. Moving on. Next game is 63 Days, developed and published by Destructive Creations. Released September 26th on Xbox One, Series X and S, and PS5 for $34.99. PS4 and PC, $29.99. Coming of Age is part of the first generation Born Free. World War II stripped me of my family, home, and future. Now I'm left with only one choice, to get my revenge and independence or die trying. The odds are against us. Will our tactics, stealth, and teamwork be enough? Aki, was it?
Kinda? Sorta? Okay, in this game, you play at the beginning as two brothers, and it expands out to a few other people as well. But you guys are Polish, and this is World War II, so, you know, bad things be happening. Very bad things. And you decide, well, I think it might just be a little bit of time to kill us some Nazis. So,
yeah, you two, buddy.
Damn straight. So you two go about doing that. Each character, you control both characters, up to four characters in total later on in the game. I believe I haven't actually gotten four of them unlocked all at once, but I believe you're going to have four. You get to control all of them all at once. They're all on the board at the same time. You control them individually or all together as one cohesive unit, if you so desire. And basically, each character has their own capabilities. The younger brother that they call Youngster, he throws daggers, which are not exactly quiet for some reason, but not as loud as guns. And he's also lighter weight, so he's able to climb up vines and things like that. However, he's not particularly strong, so he can't carry bodies around, and sometimes he needs to be boosted up to areas because he doesn't have the upper arm strength. Whereas the older brother is able to come up behind people and strangle the ever-loving fuck out of them until they're dead. And then he gets to cart them around and toss them into bushes. Because what's better than a dead Nazi? One that's hidden so no one else gets alerted. The two of you each have your own abilities. The younger one obviously can throw the knife, as well as he is able to throw rocks to get guards to turn and look at wherever he threw them for a little bit. The older brother has the ability to knock people out. Well, I say knock them out, but he's strangling the shit out of them. And also to yell to get guards to actually come towards him. They're both also able to pick up weapons that you pull off of the fucking Nazis. Any ammo that Nazi has used out of that gun is gone from that gun, which is kind of interesting. I do like that. And you can't get any more ammunition off of them because for some reason you're not pickpocketing the rest of their ammo for reasons I don't comprehend. So you actually, everyone drops their weapons when you kill them, and you can pick up ammunition out of those guns and the like, which is nice. The biggest problem with that is the weapons stay around. So you'll hover over them like, ooh, I need ammo. Oh, that one's empty. Okay, ooh, that one, oh, that's empty. Or they'll all be bunched up and it's real hard to get the one that you actually want. Because there's a handful of different types of weapons. Then there's other characters that each have their own abilities. Like, there's a medic later on in the game that can heal people up some. There's characters that are really small and they can club people and crawl into spaces that everyone else can't fit into, things like that. The majority of this game is realistically a stealth game, because if you attract the Nazis, they're going to shoot you, and you're not an action hero. You're just some Polish dudes. You're gonna die. Don't get shot. So, you use their abilities basically to kill entire bases individual by individual in a painstakingly slow manner. If you want to know how slow this is, there's a prologue and then there's six chapters. I'm in chapter 3 and I've spent about 11 hours in the game.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah. These levels are not exactly fast. And I'm playing on easy, folks. I decided I wasn't going to play it on hard because I was like, I'm just going to get through this real quick. I'll beat it in a day, whatever. I fucking wish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And yeah, each level has the things that you have to do, but it also has optional quests, more or less, that you can do for achievements. Some of those are, they're usually like, oh, free the prisoners so that they're not killed, and basically you have to do that quietly or else the Nazis will shoot them all. Sometimes it's like, oh, get through this section within this many minutes, which all really suck, and stuff like that. So, yeah, that is a majority of the game right there.
Are you having fun with it?
Oh, I've thoroughly enjoyed my time about as much as I've wanted to bash my head through walls. this game is very deadly. It does not give a shit that you are the player. It will kill you. It will kill you. It will kill you. And it will kill you some more. And the thing is, if either of any of your characters die, it's game over. You're going back to your last save. And it has a tendency to autosave in just the absolute fucking worst places, so you'll have to jump back a couple saves. And there's only one manual save, so it's lovely. So yeah, it's really hard, but it's also, for me, really fun, because it's still a stealth game, and I really like stealth games, but yeah. It is very punishing.
It clocks in at $34.99. Give us your thoughts.
If you like stealth games, this is a 100% buy it. This is amazing. If you do not like stealth games, this is so punishing, I don't think you're going to end up liking it.
Sounds good. We got one final game to talk about tonight, and it's some DLC for Atari 50, The Wider World of Atari. Developed by Digital Eclipse, published by Atari, released September 26th on all platforms as DLC for Atari 50 for $7.99, part of the Expanded Edition DLC bundle for $13.99. Atari 50 is available now for $39.99 or the Expanded Edition for $49.99. The story's not over yet. The Wider World of Atari introduced a new timeline with more games, historical artifacts, and video interviews that explore the creation of Atari games. From early arcade games through fan-made homebrew titles, you'll learn why passionate Atari fans are loyal for life. Chris, tell us about your time with Atari 50,
yay!
The Wider World of Atari DLC.
What was up with the yay interrupting that?
He finally got it right. I wanted to congratulate him.
Oh.
Fair.
All right. Yeah, I think my internet should be back now. Yeah, it completely cut out at the end of that interview. Yeah. So, this DLC for Atari Age, which of course, as you, if you didn't catch my review before or just didn't know, is a Digital Eclipse release of basically a huge collection of Atari games, but not only that, it's a fully curated digital museum. That is to say, lots of placards, lots of reading, lots of material that you can, like, you know, kind of zoom in on and take a real close look at, and video interviews with the people who made the games and, you know, various people who just know a lot about Atari. This DLC is basically the same thing, except that, yeah, it kind of goes off into a couple of different directions that, you know, it kind of feels like, so you know how, like, when you watch a, like, really good documentary and it may have, like, some DVD extras or something like that, and they just go off on, like, other parts of the story that were, like, really fascinating and relevant but didn't quite, you know, fit the narrative that was going on in the film? I watch a lot of documentaries, so that's, you know... That's kind of what this feels like. It feels like, I would say, maybe about three little, like, these would be like three additional, like, 10-minute long documentary scenes that weren't included in the movie, right? Because it would have made the movie like 3 hours long. Whereas, you know, Atari, like, the Atari 50 is like way more than 3 hours worth of stuff, but you know what I mean. So yeah, we'll basically go through, like, you know, the bits of that. So one of them, of course, they do talk about the different Atari games, and, like, they kind of go on about, like, different sort of innovations in you know, in the games, like different control schemes and things like that. And, of course, they let you play the games, and the games have been adapted for, you know, modern controllers so that you don't have to worry about it. But, you know, they talk about, like, the invention of the rollerball controller and, like, how that kind of worked in arcades and how it factored into, you know, Atari's football game, literally called Atari Football, because this is the 70s. They could just name stuff that, you know. or, like, you know, this, you know, the... what was I going to say? Yeah, like Superbug, for instance, is one that has, you know, some basically like a thing talking about overlays. Destroyer is playable, and that talks about, like, the dial controller that they used. A really good one that I actually really enjoyed playing is Skydiver, which had these, like, parachute hooks that you would pull on in order to... basically, Skydiver is a single screen game where a plane flies by and you jump out as your skydiver and then open the chute, or don't, and just squish into the ground. And you know, the idea is to, you know, get your chute open, and then you kind of you know, I guess in the original game you were to use the hooks to kind of pull yourself left and right against the wind in order to hit a target, you know, kind of like pilot wing style, which is really cool. And of course, in this iteration you're using a controller, but yeah, that was a really fun one. And they included both the arcade version that was, you know, really cool, and also the 2600 version. And then that kind of leads into what I'm going to call, like, the second phase of like the or the second, let's call it, like, the second cut scene, right? Where they talked about the division in the, like, you know, kind of the early 80s, they talk about how the arcade wing of Atari's developers and the console, like, home port wing, the people working on the VCS, you know, / 2600 console, and the games were kind of all different teams, and, like, literally they just kind of didn't, like, at least the company kind of made steps to kind of keep them separated. So, you know, they'd even be working on, like, the same concept of games, but they'd be kind of working on them at the same time. So, like, they kind of talk about, like, how different some of the home ports were because of the kind of separation of like, the home console and the arcade thing. So that was a really interesting, you know, that's mostly done through video, but they demonstrate it by, you know, of course, like, providing the home console version of Skydiver, which... despite being similar, you know, was developed, like, at the same time, but by a different team. And so that's kind of cool. They also talk about, I guess you could say, four maybe sections, because they also talk about box art concepts, They do an extended interview with Evelyn Seto, who is a graphic designer at Atari. You know, she inked the Fuji logo, you know, the famous Atari logo, those three lines, and things like that. So they talked about that. There's a touching on that and also the kind of home console versus arcade bit of it. They do a lot of stuff around Berserk, which if you don't know Berserk, it's a game where you're a guy running around a maze that's kind of procedurally generated because they were doing that stuff even back then. And, you know, your thing is to shoot robots and try to get through the maze and everything. And the robots, it was like one of the earliest games to feature digitized voice. And because digitized voice already sounded robotic, they actually used it to voice the robots who would talk shit about you if you died, which is fantastic. And, you know, they include, like, the sequel to it that came out in arcades, Frenzy. They, you know, break out the both the 2600 and 5200 versions of Berserk made by different people. The 5200 version, of course, actually retained the voice samples. But, and this is kind of transitioning to the last part of the collection, they also included the Berserk voice enhanced version, which actually was released in 2002 by, you know, that would be from Mike Mika, who is, you know, I think the main person behind Digital Eclipse. So there's a little bit of a us talking to ourselves aspect to it as well. So you kind of get to learn about, like, not the origins of Digital Eclipse so much, but, like, you know, you kind of get to learn a little more about who Mike Mika is, for instance. And by the way, apologies if I messed up his name. I've only ever seen it printed.
Pretty sure it's Mike Mika.
Mike Mika. Okay. Yeah, excuse me.
He used to visit us on the show quite a lot back in the day. I've been trying so hard to get him back on, but
I see him around.
An ungodly busy person.
Yeah, I see him around the internet. It's one of those people
such
who
a great guy.
Yeah, definitely seems like it. Yeah, just he's one of those people that, like, I'm sure I have plenty of mutual friends with him. It's just, like I said, I don't know because I just hadn't heard his name pronounced before. So thank you for that. So yeah, Mike Mika, talking about or, you know, like I said, sharing the Berserk 2600 version that has the voice action in it as well, which is pretty cool. And then that kind of gets into the final topic, which is talking about the kind of homebrew movement and, you know, kind of how that originated and sort of became like a big thing where it kind of eventually became officially like part of Atari, especially with the Atari, what is it called? That the digital system that came out.
The VCS?
No, not the VCS. I should know this one. I keep wanting to say Atari Age, but it's actually, that's the name of the web forum that they talk about and stuff. But anyway, we'll get there. Let's see. Oh, the Atari's Flashback 2. The system, yeah. If you remember, that system came out. I actually almost bought that one. I really, really wish I would have. But they talk about, like, games, homebrew games, and, like, there's also, actually, before that even, there's a section of what they call post-NES games that came out on the 2600 and such, so they kind of share, like, some five, like, more advanced kind of 2600 games that came out, like, you know, between 1987 and 1991. So stuff like Desert Falcon is in there, Double Dunk, Super Football, which had a kind of behind the back of the team, but also kind of isometrically pointed towards the field goal, which is like the view they kind of still use in football games. So it was like the first game to kind of do that, by their admission. Also Off the Wall, which is a very fun breakout kind of, I'm not going to say clone, but like a breakout style game that featured a person that you would run around instead of like just the paddle, which reminded me of a game I really liked on the NES called Thunder and Lightning, so it was nice to play that. I always love a good breakout style game. But anyways, yeah, so then they start talking about Adventure 2, which of course they actually shared. But yeah, Adventure 2 was like basically a homebrewed Atari, you know, it was a 5200 game, and then they brought it out for the Atari Flashback 2 in 2005, so it became like an official Atari game. And then they shared a few others like that, you know, like Return to Haunted House, and then Aquaventure and Save Mary, which I don't know if y'all remember, if y'all were on, I don't know if y'all were on the internet in 2023, but... I remember there being like a bunch of hubbub about Save Mary and like how they had physical versions that that officially came out and they kind of sold out real quickly. So they talk about that a little bit. And yeah, they kind of like talk about how Atari kind of like really adopted and, you know, kind of put out these games as official products, you know, based on the strength of their very you know, very prolific homebrew group. And it also talks about the kind of, and you know, the other there's a little bit of this in the main game too, but they do talk about like prototypes and how those kind of surfaced and are still surfacing. You know, they talk about the Atari Age forums, which, you know, is a significant part of the Atari history for sure. And yeah, that's pretty much the content. So it's like kind of talking about previously unreleased stuff, you know, post NES stuff, and then a little bit more of the history that I, like I said, you know, doesn't quite fit into the rest of it, like the games with unusual controls, and you know, talking to the developers and about the separation of the arcade and homebrew development team. And yeah, in total there's 19 games that are available on this thing. Those, they aren't all unique. So, you know, some of them are just different versions of like the same game, but again, they're all kind of worth playing because they all tend to be really different. But yeah, like on its own, this would be like a really good little collection of games and content. But yeah, just the fact that it's a, you know, just an expansion of like this gargantuan, you know, historical, tome of the early days of gaming, it was really, really cool.
Best part is there's a second DLC coming later.
Yeah, hoping to check that out too.
So this one runs $8. What are your thoughts?
Oh yeah, definitely worth it. I mean, if you haven't picked up Atari 50 yet, then you may want to actually just pick up the full set, because that sounds like that's going to be the bargain. But I mean, if you do have Atari 50 and you've run through a lot of the a lot of the videos and the games and such, like this is the same thing. Like I said, it's just more of the same. And some of the games are extremely good. I actually forgot to mention that they included Red Baron in this one, which I believe was also included in the Atari Flashback collection. You know, that's just the games, no history or anything like that. But that's a really fun vector based dogfighting shooter that they actually later kind of churned into the Atari Star Wars game, which is actually one of my favorite Atari games. So lots of fun games to play here. I, like I said, particularly like Skydiver. Avalanche was really fun. I didn't really talk about that, but it's a good one. Really liked Red Baron. And of course I do actually like Berserk and Frenzy both quite a lot. I like that style of game. So there's a lot to enjoy here, even if you're not really into the history part. And then, like I said, it gets into like homebrew and stuff and includes that Save Mary game that, you know, you can't really buy physically anymore. So, yeah, $8, absolutely worth it.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. We are finished with this episode. Congrats, everyone. We made it through.
Nice.
Big thanks.
Reviews are less than an hour.
Yeah. Well. When there's only quick. Five.
Well, yeah, still. <so. laughs>
Then again, with this team, it could have gone 3 hours. Or no.
See, there you go. And it gave us more time to talk over the interview.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, those of us who could talk, because my internet was going out.
I was going to say, out of all the games that you heard about tonight, Joe, which one was your favorite? Or which one would you go pick up if you were a consumer?
Out of the five tonight, I think I would want to check out Bloomtown the most.
Why that one?
Just because of the style? Into RPGs.
Nice.
Like RPGs. So I would want to... That and the Atari deal. Because I love Atari 50.
Yeah, I was DLC already planning on...
Seems awesome.
I was already planning on buying the DLC, so that's kind of my answer.
Yeah.
what about the other guys?
Andy?
Honestly, Bloom... I was checking out each game as everybody was talking about it, too. Atari 50 DLC looked really cool. I like those old-style games, too. Probably that one, Bloomtown... Drive Rally interested me a little bit. I thought that would be pretty neat. I like driving games.
What about Kvark? Have you played that one?
I have played that one. Yeah, that one's pretty good too. That's you know, another boomer shooter for sure. Yeah, that's my specialty. You know, I'm trying to play some different games, you know, lately. So,
well, you got a fun one for next week.
Heck yeah, dude! I'm stoked for next week.
Yeah. Well, we'll save that for next week. For this week, we are going to wrap things up with some music. Does anyone have any recommendations for music to play this episode? Otherwise, I'm probably going to pick something from like old school Project Majestic Mix for the old school RPG.
There you go.
Shit people can't buy anymore. So I'm going to play shit that people can't get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's kind of in the spirit of Atari 50, right?
Yeah, there we go. Burger Thing, okay. Thank you so much for the sub. Just went off right there. Thank you so much for the 1 year subscription. Really appreciate it. Thank you for your support. Enjoy the emotes. Want to give a quick thanks to Josh Halloran for coming on, chatting about 8-bit adventures with us. The game is out next week. We will have a full review next week as well. So stay tuned to the show for more information. Big thanks to Adam for coming on, chatting about his game. Thanks to all you for being here for the whole show. Andy, for the time you've been here. You know what I mean. Does anyone have any final words to end the show?
Farfig Newton.
Got him.